I've been asked in the few moments that follow to encourage us to take a little bit of time out from all of the busyness and the preparation that goes into Christmas at this time of year. I don't know how your own preparations are going. I think we're just about on track. I, for one, am very grateful for internet shopping at this time of year. It covers a multitude of sins, but I hope your preparations are on track. But I've been asked to encourage us just to take a few moments out and to help us to think about the real meaning of this festival that we all celebrate at this time of year. And I'm going to try and do so with the help of one or two sentences from this most famous of all Christmas readings, I guess, that Hamish just read to us, particularly the final sentence that Hamish read there, little sentence number 18, verse 18, where John, the very good friend of Jesus, writes, "No one has ever seen God, but God, the one and only, who is at the Father's side, has made him known." And I've got two thoughts for us that I hope will take us to the heart of what Christmas is really all about. Here's the first. Christmas means that we can know God. Christmas means that we can know God. We used to live down in London. We moved out 3 or 4 years ago. Just before we left London, it was my birthday, and Emily, my wife, took me to the Old Vic Theatre to see a play called Inherit the Wind, starring Kevin Spacey. It was one of the best plays I think I've ever seen, best performances anyway. I've never before or since stopped and bought the script on the way out of a play, but I did it on that day because it made a deep impression on me. I guess I spent quite a lot of time thinking about questions of truth and spirituality and religion and listening to what folks in our generation say about those things. And that was a play that, it seemed to me, very much captured the mood music of our time in relation to all of those questions. If you don't know the play, it's a telling of 1920s America, and in particular the Scopes trial that happened as to whether or not the evolutionary theory of Charles Darwin should be taught in schools. And the two main characters in the play are the two lawyers on either side of that debate. One's a reverend, a guy called Matthew Brady, and then the other is Henry Drummond, who is played by Kevin Spacey, saying, yes, of course, we should be teaching it. And the play makes an enormous virtue of being open-minded. And it lambasts anybody on either side of the debate who claims that they possess any sort of absolute truth. I don't know what you'll make of that, but there's a key moment in the play when Spacey says, "The man who has got everything figured out is probably a fool. Takes a very wise man to say, I don't know the answer." And that's the message of the play. So there are fundamentalist atheists on one side of the play, and they're very bad people. And then there are fundamentalist believers on the other side of the play, and they're very stupid people. And the play encourages us to take our seat somewhere on the fence in the middle and to say, when it comes to the ultimate questions of life, I don't know the answer. Maybe I can't even know the answer, so let's just forget about these claims and get on with being good people instead. But you'll see, if you glance down again at little sentence 18 there, that it challenges that sort of agnosticism, that sort of I don't know answer, absolutely head on. As John says, no one's ever seen God, but God, the one and only, who is at the Father's side, has made him known. I take it the first half of that can't be all that controversial. No one's ever seen God. That's why there's so much debate about his existence, his nature, his identity. No one's ever seen God. But then the second half says that God has not left us in the dark about him. As John continues, speaking of Jesus, God, the one and only, God the Son, who is at the Father's side, has made him known. Let me try and illustrate John's point rather trivially. When Emily was pregnant with our eldest, Freddie, we were summoned down to Somerset, which is where Emily's grandparents lived at the time. And it was so that Gran-Gran, as she's known, who was in her 90s at that stage, could perform the test to tell us whether we were going to have a boy or a girl. So here's the way it works. Emily had to lie horizontally flat. The tummy had to be bared, which was a sight that had to be seen to be believed. And then Gran-Gran stood there for about 15 minutes trying to thread a needle. And then once she'd thread the needle, she dangled it over Emily's bump. And the theory was that if the, I think this is right. If it swayed laterally from side to side, we were going to have a boy. Is this right? And if it rotated in a clockwise direction, it meant that we were going to have a girl. And so Gran-Gran stood there like this over the bump performing this test. And she performed it twice, just so that we could be absolutely certain. The only snag was that we had differing results. Now, I was about to be a father for the first time. I was slightly anxious at this moment. What is it that we would be raising? Was it to be a boy or a girl? So I asked her, what should I conclude from all of this? And she said, well, it is absolutely certain that you are either going to have a boy or you are... And I thought, well, this is great, you know. We'd battled through London traffic. We'd driven 4 hours or whatever it was to get down to Somerset. And now at least we knew what was coming. Clearly, that was all just a bit of fun. I don't know if you've had your own kind of pet theories of how you work out. Is the bumpy and a sort of sticky outy or a sideways kind of thing? I don't know what your own pet theory is. Obviously, those things can only ever really be guesswork. But, and here would be the point, at the moment that the baby comes out, obviously the guesswork can stop and we can see the answer for ourselves. Well, down through the centuries, there have been countless theories and opinions about God. Still today, you could travel to many different cultures around the world and meet people who would say to you, I like to think of God as. And then they tell you their own pet theory of the way that they would like God to be. But the great news of Christmas is that God came from heaven to be born as a baby so that we might know for sure exactly what he is like. Do you see how little sentence 14 puts it there? The Word became flesh, the very self-expression of God became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We've seen his glory, the glory of the one and only who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. It's saying that when you look at the baby in the Christmas manger, you see God as he really is. Not a vague approximation, but the real deal. When you hear that baby grow up and start speaking to you, you hear the very words of God. If you come to know that baby, you come to know God. I suppose that the question, I'm going to try and be a little bit provocative in our time this morning. I'm hoping to generate some conversation between you and the folks that invited you along today, maybe something to talk about over lunch. Here would be the first way I would try and do that, to ask you a question to consider this Christmas. How important do you think Jesus is? These verses are saying that that baby is your maker, that he is your God, that he enables us to know the truth about God because he is God. As far as I can tell, in the whole of human history, there have only been two people of whom those around them have said, not just who is this amazing person, but what is this? Because the individual concerned seemed to be more than human to them. They did it with Gautama Buddha, and they did it with Jesus. But the really interesting thing is the very different reaction of those two men when people started saying that kind of thing. Buddha is said to have said very clearly and emphatically, no, do not look at me. It is not about me. Look away from me. Look to my Dharma. Look to my teachings. That's where it's at. But if you were to read on in John's Gospel over the course of Christmas, you would see that when people began to worship Jesus, when they fell on their knees in front of him, even though they were Jews, and even though Jesus knew that for them to do this would be a blasphemy were it not true, that would be punishable by death, when they fell on their knees and worshipped him as God, he didn't say, oh, you're getting a little bit carried away, no, it's not about me, don't be so silly. Rather, he received their worship gladly and told them that they were doing the right thing. C.S. Lewis once said, Christianity is a statement which, if false, is of no importance, and if true, is of infinite importance. The one thing it cannot be is moderately important. I met a man a very short time ago who was in St. Andrews studying for a PhD in theology. And he has done his undergraduate degree, and he's done his master's degree, and then he started on his PhD in theology. But when we were talking about it not so long ago, I asked him what he made of Jesus personally. And, you know, it had never even occurred to him that he might ask that question, who do I think that Jesus is? I want to suggest that if C.S. Lewis is right in saying that Christianity is either of no importance or of infinite importance, that that means that if my own reaction to Jesus at the moment isn't extreme, if I'm happy to have Jesus as kind of a slight side dish on the Christmas thing, a bit like, I don't know, the red cabbage, the thing that it's nice enough to have, but if it wasn't there, we wouldn't really miss it in truth. If that's the equivalent of Jesus for me, then I haven't even begun to come to terms with the magnitude of these claims. Let me move on to our second thought. We're asking, why was Jesus born in the first place? And the answer is not just so that we can learn facts about God, but so that we might know God personally as our Father. And let's see that in little sentence number 11 there, about halfway down that reading. He, Jesus, came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. Yet to all who received him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. Children born not of natural descent, nor of human decision or a husband's will, but born of God. You'll see that the sentence highlights two very different responses to Jesus. And when you look at them, initially they come, I think, as something of a shock. Here was God, or Jesus, undeniably God on earth in human history. And some people received him, while others, it says, made the very deliberate decision not to do so. And you think, well, how does that add up? You see the fuss that's made in our own generation of not just A and B and C, but even D-list celebrities and sports stars. And whenever they come to town, everyone has to make a big fuss. You think, well, when God comes to us, surely everybody is going to line the streets to welcome him. And yet, not a bit of it. Why would that be? How could it be that God would come and people wouldn't want to know him? I think the answer is illustrated brilliantly in, I think, my favorite book by Oscar Wilde called The Picture of Dorian Gray. I don't know if you've read it. They made a film of it recently. I'm sure you'll be able to catch it on Netflix if you don't want to read it over the course of Christmas. Dorian Gray's an incredibly attractive young man at the start of the book, and he has his portrait painted by, is it Basil, I think, his friend who's an artist? And the portrait is painted so beautifully that when Dorian sees it, he falls in love with his own image. You may know people who are a little bit like that when they finish in the mirror in the morning. And so he makes this sort of Faustian pact. His great longing is that he might forever on his own face retain all of the youth and beauty that he can see on the portrait in front of him. But then any of the scars that come from aging or careless living wouldn't be reflected on his own face, but would be represented on the portrait instead. Dorian gets his wish, and as he gets older in life, he proceeds to commit himself to a whole lifetime of indulgence and evil, and I think even in one case, murder. And all the while, to the shock of everyone around, his own face remains beautiful and young. And then one day he discovers the portrait of his youth, lifts back the blanket, and sees it there in front of him in all of its new ugliness. I don't know how you react when you get a glimpse of what you're really like on the inside. You do something, you say something, and you think, gosh, where did that come from? Dorian initially is so sickened by what he sees in front of him, he doesn't know what to do. But he is terrified. His main emotion is to be terrified that he might somehow be exposed in public. And so he decides to cover up the portrait again and bury it in the attic. The climax comes when Basil discovers the portrait for himself and sees it there in front of him. And so he confronts Dorian and he implores him to turn his life around. If you know anything about Oscar Wilde, it's incredible to find that the artist at this point in the book starts quoting the Bible at Dorian and urging him to change his life. He says, "Does God not say somewhere in the Bible, though, come now, let us reason together, though your sins be like scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. Though they be red like crimson, they shall be as white as wool." And so he pleads with Dorian to seek God's forgiveness. And here is another opportunity for Dorian to face reality, to change, to become a better person. But instead, he's so determined to silence this accusing voice that he reaches for a knife and he kills his friend, the artist. Well, when Jesus came into the world, his own didn't receive him. They didn't lack any evidence as to his true identity. They'd heard the miracle of his teaching. They'd seen the wonder of his life. They'd witnessed the power of his deeds. They didn't lack any evidence, but they just didn't want to listen to him. And when he began saying that they had this problem of sin, that they were so curved in on themselves that they didn't love God properly and they didn't love other people properly, they hated him for it. And when he urged them to turn their life around and to come back to God and receive him as their king, so determined were they to silence his accusing voice that they strung him up on a cross and crucified him. I know that not many in our own generation reject Jesus quite so graphically today. Most prefer either to, just relegate him to the status of the red cabbage or to ignore him completely. But these verses would suggest that the crime is the same, that Jesus came to his own. He came to us, that which he'd made, and yet we didn't receive him. That is a mistake that could haunt someone forevermore. But did you see the great promise of Christmas that's there in sentence number 12 in our reading? And with this I'll close. We read, "Yet to all who did receive Jesus, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God." Now, to receive Jesus is just to accept him on his own terms, to recognize that he is God and to live in that way. To everyone, it says here, who receives Jesus as their Lord and God, well, God personally gives to that one the right to become one of his children. One of the happiest moments for me of Christmas every year is that moment when you get reunited with a loved one that you haven't seen for a long time. Maybe they live a long way away, you don't get to see them as much as you want, but then you're reunited and it's a great thing. And you know somewhere in the back of your mind that 3-4 days from now you'll be sick of the sight of each other, you'll be desperate for them to emigrate to Australia or something. But there is that initial moment of joy when you are reconnected. I love it most when a child sees a grandparent. And it's none of the sort of normal restraint, just unbridled joy, running across the room, arms open wide, big hugs, tears, normally from granny. And then everybody is happy for that. We enjoy the bliss for as long as it lasts. Happy reunions are a wonderful thing. And verse 12 is offering to us, incredibly, the chance of, if I may put it this way, a happy reunion with God himself, even and despite of the way that we have treated him. The chance to have all of our wrongdoing wiped away. The chance to be restored to a satisfying relationship with God in which we know him as our Father. And it doesn't get any better than that. It's worth asking myself then, how am I responding to Jesus? What do I make of him? Have I received him in this way as my Lord and my King? I'm sure that there'll be some there who are crying out for more evidence. I want to say that is exactly the right response to these verses. These verses are designed as an introduction and an appetite whetter to John's gospel. His aim is to put big claims out there and then to spend another 20-odd chapters justifying those claims. So he would very much want you to pick up a copy of his gospel to read it through. I think we've got copies of Luke to give away downstairs somewhere, and maybe some John's too. So if you'd like to take one of each and you're a visitor today, you'd be very, very welcome to do so. But John intends that the rest of his book will substantiate these claims that are the most provocative and outrageous, I think, probably that you could find anywhere on the planet this morning. I hope you'll take one away and read it. And if a friend brought you here today, I know they'd be delighted to talk it through with you in the new year when all the the fusses of Christmas has died down. But I suppose the one thing that no one would want to do is to reject claims of this magnitude. They're pretty big, aren't they? I'm guessing that no one would want to reject them out of hand without first taking the time to investigate them and to think about them clearly as a grown-up. Because as C.S. Lewis said, the one thing they cannot be is moderately important.